miles of black ribbon on the lone highway. Men turn into boys on the lone highway. Rest up creeps thrive on the lone highway. Pretty girls beware out on the lone highway. On the lone highway. Revolution Radio, it's Saturday, and it's time for the Scorpio Conspiracy Show with your host, Scorpio. Lost a little honey on the lone highway. Left me for another.
Hello, and welcome to the Scorpio Conspiracy Show. Today's date is Saturday, July 11th, 2020. And here we are, another week in the open-air insane asylum we call Earth. And by now, I think everyone out there is suffering from a severe case of corona fatigue. Yeah, I think so, right? Corona fatigue. It's become ubiquitous and all-pervasive in our society. I mean, everywhere you go, there's some kind of reminder of it, right? You know, if it's someone wearing a mask or a sign somewhere, or you go on an internet site, it says, oh, get the latest coronavirus news. Click here. You know, it's just something else. Or maybe you see someone smearing, you know, hand sanitizer all over themselves compulsively, you know? See that a lot now. The other day, I saw a guy in his car with the windows up, his mask on, and he was, you know, just rubbing hand sanitizer all over himself. You know, it was a little strange. Hot day, too. Yeah, so it's gotten a little crazy, a little nutty, or as they say down here, bien loco. But, you know, as crazy as this corona hoax is, it really does present some opportunities for us to envision, you know, a new future for ourselves. You know, to envision a future apart from what these globalist parasites have cooked up for us. And, you know, remember, the first step to creation is visualization, you know. Because, you know, you can't expect to manifest anything in this world until you know what you want first. That's the first step, visualization. So I really see right now we have an opportunity. You know, it's time to really start visualizing the kind of reality that we want to live in and not accept this dystopic version of the future that a very small percentage of people in the world have cooked up for us. There's no reason for us to accept it any longer. And, you know, there isn't anybody in government right now, except for maybe President Trump, who has any vision whatsoever. You know, people are just looking to increase the power and scope of the federal government. And, you know, I don't think increasing the power of government is going to solve anything. I think that ship has sailed, and it should be clear to everyone by now that centralized government has caused far more problems than it's ever solved. Far more. And I don't think that's going to change. So really, you know, if you're on the left or if you're on the right, decentralization is the key. Decentralization of everything. I mean, that's a concept that's really been around in my mind lately. Decentralization. And for example, here's an example of opportunity that sort of, you know, comes to us right now. They're saying, oh, we can't open the public schools because of coronavirus. Okay, good. Let's not open the public schools. Good idea. I fully support it. It's too dangerous. So let's abolish public schools completely because they're an unmitigated disaster right now. And it's because, you know, they're too centrally controlled. And it's time for people to start getting involved in their own solutions and not look to, you know, government to go, oh, we'll just send our kid off to school and everything will be okay. You know, it's time for local people to organize and start creating the schools that they want for their kids on a very localized level. You know, it could start with just like groups of mothers that are homeschooling, get a big group together and start making a curriculum. You can't just look to government to fix our problems anymore, because look what it's brought us. It's brought us the biggest hoax that we've ever lived through right now with this corona crisis, the biggest hoax we've ever seen. It makes 9/11 look like a walk in the park. So the scope of this fraud has grown. The fraud of our government has grown and grown. So we need to start looking to other places other than this standard old political solutions. And, you know, the other day I heard it said that the federal government, we've been spending $45 billion a year in Afghanistan, right? Afghanistan, $45 billion a year. And you look at all the hundreds of thousands of homeless people in the United States right now. I mean, how many tiny homes could you build for people with $45 billion? Well, it turns out you could build 4,500,000 tiny homes at $10,000 each. Okay? 4,500,000 tiny homes at $10,000. I mean, that's an amazing prospect of what we could actually do rather than squander it on, you know, the United Nations and the WHO and, you know, wars in Afghanistan. And we've been in Afghanistan for 17 years. So if you run the numbers on that, we could have built 76,500,000 tiny homes in the last 17 years. Just to make sure that, you know, homeless people and poor people have a place to live. And, you know, that's not so out there and bizarre. It could be done very, very easily. But, you know, we're not dealing with people that have any vision right now. And, you know, add to that, you know, community gardens for every neighborhood, big community gardens for every neighborhood. I mean, you could start changing people's lives quickly and getting people involved in their own in betterment of their lives. And, you know, that wouldn't mean you have to send soldiers overseas and have people killed. No reason for that, man. It's ridiculous. It really is. So anyway, those were just a couple of thoughts I had about what's going on today. And I think the big thing right now is we just cannot accept the reality they have cooked up for us, man. It just ain't going to fly anymore. That said, I'd like to bring on Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. Giuseppe, how you doing, buddy?
Doing well, my friend. Your intro was spot on, as always. I mean, we are at war with a small cadre of global parasites, global elites, and they are out to destroy our sovereign nation, our way of life as decent Americans. And we need to fight it, regain our sovereignty, and destroy those satanic subhuman parasites.
Yeah, you kind of coined the term parasitical elite, and I really like that term. I picked it up, and because it's very descriptive, just saying elite isn't the proper thing to say because it gives them too much credibility. Parasitical elite is much more accurate.
Well, sure. I mean, in the history of this nation, you've always had the elite who are wealthy, who some are snobby, some are just, you know, hardworking and clever and figured out how to make a lot of money. And they have the country clubs and they have the Mercedes top end cars and the mansions on the hill, as Neil Young says. And that's cool. That's how this country should work for people who earn it. But the parasitical elite, they do not earn it. They feed on the real economy. They feed on the real people. They are some satanic, dark mojo cultists that do not deserve to exist on this planet.
Yes, good point. Good point. Well, this week, you know, we have a guest on. It's Dr. Raphael Johnson. And due to scheduling, he's a very busy guy right now. So we had to pre-record the interview, which is something we don't usually do here on live radio. But This is a really, really good interview, and I've been thinking about our conversation with him. And one thing he said to us is that he's more busy than he's ever been because so many people around him and in his sphere of influence want to know what's going on. And I think we're all sort of in a sweet spot right now because it's becoming, you know, painfully obvious to average people, so-called normies, that something is very wrong with our society. And I think they're getting a strong feeling they're not being told the truth.
Yes. I think that for whatever reason, part of their occult calendar, or because of fear, because the internet they thought they could use as a tool of mind control became a global information sharing tool for the regular people, somewhat awake to totally awake people of this every nation. And that completely scares them because the only thing they have is the illusion of control and the parasitic overlord of the system. If people were to wake up and realize literally we're talking about, you know, at the very top, a couple thousand people, and then their active minions, maybe 100,000 worldwide, and we're talking about over 7 billion people on the planet, I mean, they could be eliminated in a week. And you wouldn't even have to sanction that many of them. You take care of business with some, and the rest will go scurrying to whatever bunker they'll hide in, and that'll be that.
And it's kind of like when a cockroach scurries away when you turn the light on in the kitchen, right?
Yeah, man, that's exactly right. And they've gone all in with this insane scam to mandatory vaccinations, wearing masks, stay in your home. It's so insane, and it's just, it's evil, Scorpio. It's absolutely evil. And the listeners will hear in the interview at some point, Dr. Johnson goes, you know, finally this attack, white people are starting to wake up and realize that we need to band together. And you know, I think that's true. And I also believe that this is a class war too. And so, you know, middle class Mexicans, middle class blacks, middle class Japanese, middle class Chinese, as long as you're loyal to this country and are part of the great experiment that is the United States, you know, this isn't a white racist thing. This is about everybody being able to own a home if you work hard, and everybody holding on to a job and going to the park with your kids and going to see a concert. And they're stealing all that from us with a lie, just because the potential of global societal control with this ridiculous vaccine. There'll never be a vaccine for the coronavirus. There'll never be a vaccine for the flu. Those microbials mutate constantly, and the whole corporate mainstream hegemony that we're at a war against viruses. And it's like, viruses are one of the three fundamental building blocks of life, along with fungi and bacteria. There's the creators, God, the builders, whatever you want to call the remarkable entities that set us up as we are on this planet. They knew how to do it. And the arrogance of these hubristic scum who think they can tweak one strand of RNA and they're the kings of the world, and all they do is mess it up. And anyone who is stupid enough, moronic enough to take that vaccine, you are playing Russian roulette with four bullets in the chambers.
Oh, that's a good analogy. Yeah, it's incredible. You know, the other day I saw, you know, this little toddler in a carriage with a mask on, and then the mother had put a plastic sheet over the carriage. I felt sorry for the poor little kid. It was almost like, you know, the boy in the bubble, you know, just totally disconnected from the world. And it's just sad to see so many people falling in line and believing this. But I think that's changing very rapidly.
I hope so. I mean, that's not healthy at all for that little toddler.
No, it's not. Supposed to be building up his immune system. But that said, why don't we go ahead and start the interview with Dr. Raphael Johnson, and then we'll maybe pick up at the bottom of the hour again.
Sounds good. Let me know that you hear this. I'm starting sharing now, and I'm going to start the interview.
I'm not hearing anything. Are you?
Oh, you're not?
No.
Hold on. Okay, let's try it again. Here we go.
Okay, I'm here
can you hear it?
Dr. Raphael Johnson. Great. And my co-host, Giuseppe. Giuseppe, how are you today?
Oh, I'm doing wonderfully, and it's a great honor to have an intellect the caliber of Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson on the show with us.
Yes, Dr. Johnson, thank you so much for coming on the show. How are you doing?
Well, other than the early hour of the call and the fact I haven't gotten my damn stimulus check yet, I'm doing fine.
Okay. Okay. Well, Dr. Johnson, could you just, for those listeners who might not be familiar with you, could you possibly just give a little bit on your background and, you know, how you got involved in this kind of research?
The reason I was a musician in the late 80s, I got into the Hart School of Music, which is very selective, so I must have been pretty good. Didn't want to be a funeral director like my father, even though I would have made a hell of a lot more money. And then on Christmas Day, 1989, the Ceausescus were executed by the army, and that was put on television. And that was the event that got me very interested in, as the Soviet Union began to crumble. But that particular event struck me. And at the time, I was with the National Traditionalist Caucus. It's Don Rosenberg's group in Manhattan, New York City. I'm from New Jersey. And he was deeply involved in Russian monarchy and things like that. He was a Russian Jew who converted to Orthodoxy and, you know, was my first teacher on the Jewish question. And like so many former Jews, he was quite militant in his views of the matter. And so he was a great first teacher. He's still around. And then I went to college. I did political science and history. And then somehow I went from being a musician to getting a doctoral degree in the history of political philosophy. So there was a transition in there that I'm still a little bit foggy on. But I do think it has something to do with the Ceausescu's murder. And besides that, in the 1990s, I began to realize, and again, I also got this from Don, that Russia was going to be the only entity that could fight American liberalism, that the U.S. wasn't the good guy anymore. It was the head of the Hydra. The leader of the free world is in Russia. Now, it wasn't the case in the 90s, of course, because Russia was taken over by the Western world at the time, and it almost disappeared. But the very fact that a huge empire can collapse outside of wartime, just under its own weight, and lose 80% of its GDP overnight, is something that's never happened in the history of the world. So it also struck me that things can change very quickly. The CIA was saying that the Soviet Union was economically solid in 1990. That's how incompetent they are. No one except Solzhenitsyn seemed to have predicted the fall of the USSR. And it was very odd to me that no one saw this coming. They were so used to defending and supporting the Soviet Union that, but when even the CIA refused to see it, even after it was happening, refused to see it. I said, there's a lot more going on here than meets the eye. My father being veteran of the Korean War, where he lost most of his left rib cage and his left hand from a Chinese mortar, I also felt in a kind of a weird way that he helped in a small way the toppling of the system by fighting the Soviet client state in North Korea, although it was mostly Chinese at the time. So for all these reasons, I got into this field, and you know, despite me having no ideological friends in the university, you know, I was a nice guy, and people liked me. They thought I was crazy. But, you know, when I was an undergraduate, the main professor that promoted me, who wrote all my letters to grad school, I did my senior thesis under, was a Jewish homosexual Marxist named Victor de Lubin, who said, you know what, I think you're crazy, but you're good at what you do. And that was at the University of Hartford. He died of AIDS in 1997. It's a very bizarre thing to say, but it's true. So he didn't really care about.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point, because you do have to give credit where credit is due if you're going to be intellectually honest.
Well, there are guys that, you know, he was old school. I mean, he just said, okay, you're good at what you do. It doesn't make any difference whether or not you agree with me. And he was an excellent influence. And he even said to me, he said, well, this is good for me too, because I need to hear this stuff from a sympathetic point of view. I took a lot of my teaching style when I taught at various universities afterwards from him. His teaching style was to, when he taught political theory, which was his thing, and he taught, say, you know, conservatism, he would put himself in a conservative mindset and present conservatism in the most sympathetic way possible. He would do it from Marxism and liberalism and anarchism and everything else. That's how he taught. So it took a long time for anyone to realize what he was politically. And I ended up doing the same thing. You can't understand a theorist unless you understand him from the inside. So yeah, he was a good guy despite his perversion.
Well, yes. And that kind of intellectual discourse seems to be a thing of the past within academia. What do you think happened? How did we get to where we are now in academia? Because, you know, Marxist teachers like that, that have that sense of intellectual, you know, longing and wanting to know more information seems to be a thing of the past. What do you think happened?
Well, I did my undergraduate at the University of Hartford in Connecticut. And it's one of the most expensive schools in the country. And we competed. Their competition was Yale, Trinity, Bridgeport, Harvard, Boston College. That was NYU even. So when we decided to go there, they treated us really, really, really well. We had Peter Bright was the chairman of the department, who was a very difficult man, very leftist though. And he had an adjunct who just promoted liberalism in the classroom to the point where it interfered with his teaching. I said something to Peter, and he took care of the problem. He said, that's not how you teach this university. Whether I agree with you or not is irrelevant. You don't go in there spouting and advocacy. That's not teaching. You know, yeah, that is a thing of the past. Now, what happened? And now, the minute I went to big state schools, did my MA and PhD in two huge state universities, it's a totally different attitude. And of course, in the Ivy Leagues, professors aren't there to teach. They don't teach anybody. They're there to do research and to get government grants and to give a certain veneer of respectability to official liberalism.
Yes, publish or perish.
Well, yeah. I mean, I published too, and I still perished. But that was the, you know, I published more than my colleagues have, and so there's an ideological side to this too. But yeah, publish or perish in the sense that, you know, you go to an Ivy League school for a doctoral degree. Well, you're not there to learn. You actually act as a research assistant to a professor doing his own thing. It's not much of an education. It's not an education at all. Actually, you're there to simply give him free research and to do the stuff he doesn't feel like doing. That's what, you know, Ivy League doctoral degree is. It's a little different for the bigger state schools and places like Pennsylvania. But the left, you know, used its great foundations, you know, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, to completely take over academia and then protect itself with speech codes, which were just being imposed around the time I was at Hartford. And you had a lot of liberals at the time saying, being very against this stuff. The ACLU was initially against this stuff. All the speech codes that you take for granted now were just being imposed. Say things I said in the classroom were reported by other liberal students, and the liberal professors, you know, shut them down. No, that's what this is. Yeah, this is about discourse. This, you know, so this was brand new in the early 90s.
Okay, we're at the break. We'll be right back, guys. Stay tuned. Okay, we're back here on Revolution Radio, And let's jump right back into our interview with Dr. Raphael Johnson.
Up to do that. And then when Stacy Coons wrote his, yeah, that was his last name, wrote his defense of himself as one of the cops, no publisher would touch it. It was called Presumed Guilty, a very good book. Figure any publisher would make a fortune, one of the cops at the Rodney King thing, and no one would touch it. So no one really knows his point of view. It ended up being a Regnery publication. The media has full and total power over the political world to the extent that people think that the media and the political world is one and the same. You go to any congressional office, you'll have Fox or CNN going in the background 24/7. They control this. The thing about journalists is that they're not historians or economists or political scientists. None of them are. They have no education in that area. They're journalists.
Well, you know what's funny about my first degree was in a dual degree from the University of Wisconsin, journalism and mass communication, radio, TV, and I worked as a professional journalist in the early 80s through about 1990. And I was one of the final generations of graduates that actually practiced journalism, which is the newspaper at the time, the Morning Daily, was the Milwaukee Sentinel, largest in the state. They said, you know, objectivity, the only people who get to write opinions are the editorial department. And so now when you see the people you describe as journalists, I don't think they are. They're like propagandists, don't you think?
Well, coming out of the Columbia School of Journalism, you know, truth isn't an important category for these people. But that's not relevant. The truth is always messy and complicated. It doesn't sell papers. It doesn't get viewers. The point of journalism today is to get a story, to get an angle, to get a human interest thing here that they could simply, even if they have to invent it, and create this morality play and create this narrative where you have the black hats and the white hats, something that'll appeal to a mass viewing audience and keep them there and keep them coming back. That's their job. Now, of course, they'll simply invent stories. You know, I discovered Johnson's Law. This is my law of social science, which I named after myself, that the more complex and obscure the region, or the more obscure the region, the country, the more journalists are going to lie about it because they know they can get away with it because no one knows anything about it. Either that, or they could simply be mistaken because they have no incentive to do due diligence because there are very few people that can contradict them. So they could completely invent a story. I was studying the Burmese military government at the time. I saw it again in the Uyghur issue in Western China. In these very obscure areas to Americans, they could say whatever they want. And it'll be believed because how many people know about that? How many people can? And so they have no incentive to tell the truth. You know, these concentration camps in Western China, these are manufactured stories. The concept of a foreign correspondent, it doesn't exist anymore. They're too expensive. We know that print journalism is dying. New York Times, Washington Post, they can't afford these guys anymore. So you have these kids in their 20s who never leave Washington, D.C. They'll go to an activist group, they go to Amnesty International, they go to the CIA, and that's where they write their stories from. When I did my paper on the Uyghur situation in Western China, in Xinjiang, I read pretty much every major newspaper's articles on the question, and none of them ever went to the Chinese government. They never went to the embassy. They never even went to the Chinese press to get their point of view. They just went to activist groups. You know, and why would they? If Jones didn't contradict them on it.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that's really stunning about the new left or the new people running the show is that not long ago the left was deeply suspicious of anything the CIA said or an intelligence agency said. Now, if the CIA says something, it's the word of God, and if you question it, you know, you're some kind of conspiracy theorist or something. The transformation of that is just incredible to me as well.
Well, you know, Marxism is based on conspiracy because capitalists, the owners of production, are always conspiring together, you know, to fix prices and to exploit workers and to control things. You know, it's based on a conspiracy theory. Their whole method of overthrowing a government is conspiracy, conspiratorial cells and everything else, with the Jacobins and or the Bolsheviks, whatever it is. Their whole world is conspiracy. But when they at one minute condemn any form of patriotism, and then when Donald Trump is allegedly, you know, getting the assistance of Russia for the election, suddenly they start to say this is unpatriotic to have foreign interference. You know, you realize that they have no views at all. If they can go back and forth like that, all of a sudden the CIA is wonderful. All of a sudden the U.S. military is wonderful because they're fighting national socialist governments abroad. And the military is very liberal as an institution. All of a sudden they're not attacking corporate America anymore because corporate America is equally liberal. It's a revolutionary force. Back in the early 90s, it was taken for granted this was a conservative force. They were allegedly anti-communist. And I fell for that too for a long time until I began to realize that all of their foundations, you know, every major corporation has a foundation. They give exclusively to liberal causes, including the oil companies, domestically and foreign. No, they're not. They've never been. The military is not conservative. This isn't 1950 anymore. The military is not conservative. Corporate America is not conservative. These are all liberal forces. And to this day, you have people who don't understand that. Power comes from the private sector, not the public sector.
Do you differentiate the idea of the liberal versus the idea of the globalist and the globalist agenda?
No.
So those are like interchangeable words for you?
Yeah, I mean, our vocabulary is changing here. I use liberal, conservative, left and right, even though they're distortions. I do it because that's the common vocabulary. I don't have to explain myself in depth. I've never come across a liberal who is not a globalist. Globalism versus nationalism is, of course, the big divide. And there you have Republicans and Democrats all both being globalists, although for different reasons and in different ways. But I've never come across a liberal. One of the central tenets of Marxism, and Karl Marx made this very clear, is that in the capitalist phase of development, international trade breaks down international borders and erases cultures and creates one huge market. Karl Marx was well aware that capitalism is revolutionary and that it does that. The only reason that Marxism can be internationalist is because the capitalists have already done it. They've already broken down these borders. That's why Marxism is an international. You know, Marx says this very explicitly. He says right in the Communist Manifesto, as well as in Capital and many other places. Capitalism breaks down national borders and cultures so that when Marxism finally comes along, it has a purely international system to work with. Capitalism was necessary not just to you know, accumulate the means of production and money, but it's also necessary to destroy nationalism. It's also necessary to destroy borders, to destroy relationships between different countries and create common markets.
That's a great point. Those are some really good observations, because really, when you think about it, borders are just a barrier to more customers for the corporation. So why have them? That's very interesting. What do you see as the purpose of all this, you know, rabble rousing going on with Black Lives Matters and these protests and knocking over statues? What do you think the real agenda is behind this? And what do you see as the trajectory for America in the future if this sort of thing continues?
Well, all of us in the nationalist movement predicted all of this. This really isn't interesting to me because we saw this coming. We saw this coming years ago. Now, we didn't see the virus coming. That was a new one. No one predicted that. And even when Ebola was a big thing and SARS and all that, we didn't predict it would go this far. Now, I did predict in April that they were going to use a racial – it's actually on YouTube – that they were going to use a racial event to solidify the oligarchy's control over things. Essentially, the purpose of the virus, of course, was to justify a massive bailout which they couldn't do under normal circumstances. I mean, you know, we're now into double-digit $1 trillion being pumped into Wall Street, and the Fed's balance sheet growing because they're buying all of these, you know, problematic firms and investments. They're being rescued from their own irrationality again. Of course, there's no market when your mistakes are being covered over by the Fed. And of course, the Fed, as we all know, is made up of the same elites that made those investments in the first place. And I happen to think that we need a new vocabulary, because the difference between the public and private sectors no longer exists. Most government factors, most government functions are privatized anyway, and they're privatized with the same people who run corporate America.
I agree. We do need a new vocabulary. Many of the words we use, the meanings are changing, and they don't have the same meaning that they used to.
So anyway, the point is, and the other issue, of course, is justify the bailout. They now can use the word depression, which is actually banned in journalism for a long time in America, because now they could blame a non-human entity for it. It's now, you know, the COVID depression. And, you know, of course, we've been in depression for a long time, but the system wouldn't admit that. The U.S. could be in a depression and have most people not know it, believe it or not, because of the power of the press. But the other issue is, of course, they could now buy up distressed small businesses at pennies on the dollar. And when you have racial violence throwing everyone off balance, making sure that, you know, nationalists can't talk back, that everyone is, you know, in their homes now for another reason and off balance, and these cities now have their real estate prices going down, corporate America is buying up small businesses all over the place for almost nothing. You know, interest rates are still zero, and yet your credit card is what, 19-20%? So banks can borrow at 0% interest and still charge you 20%. It's pure profit. So what you have now is like most of these things, it's a purification of the oligarchy. The difference between millionaires and billionaires is huge. When this virus first hit, it struck me that there's going to be a lot of rich people suffering. There's going to be a lot of rich guys who see their businesses go under. But then it finally struck me, something I already knew, that, you know, millionaires usually just get in the way. The billionaires are what runs everything. Small businesses, medium-sized businesses, and large businesses, they live in two different worlds. They have two different sets of agendas. Small businesses usually are on our side. Big businesses aren't. But big business can also withstand these kind of pressures for a long period of time. They have the reserves to do this, and they have the bailout to do this. Small businesses can't. I mean, only 10% of the aid to the states for COVID have been dispersed yet. But when you have, I remember it distinctly, 2 days after the lockdown was announced, there was a $2 trillion bailout. Well, that had to have been planned in advance. You can't disburse $2 billion in 2 days. That takes a little while to get all that together and to get the legal stuff out of the way. So that was planned in advance. The fact that these guys can have all of their mistakes covered over by the Fed means that there is no market. There's no free market out there that hasn't existed in a long time. Small businesses respond to the market. Big businesses create the market. They decide, and of course the press is a huge part of this, they decide what products are worth buying and what aren't, what is fashionable, what isn't. So this is like everything else, it's an economic matter. Globalization is an economic matter. That was its root. It was to make transaction costs worldwide as easy as possible, to have a race to the bottom in terms of currency and especially wages, to depress wages. You know, when you have massive third world invasions, when you have, you know, opening up the world to, you know, now billions of potential workers, wages are going to plummet. And that's really the point, not to mention the fact that when you have third worlders coming in, you really can't organize anymore. You can't organize when people are speaking different languages and when you have distrust among different races working at a plant. But that's exactly what happens. This is why the left, this is why corporate America embraced the left. So that's the trajectory. That's the point of all of this. And the racial thing is just simply to make sure that people like us don't talk very loudly, that there is going to be no talking back to this kind of thing, because now everything is racial. And when you destroy people's history and heritage, you destroy any foundation for rebellion. You can't create a movement against this stuff not knowing who you are. You know, these statues are symbolic. It's us. It's not just, you know, some statue by themselves that doesn't mean anything. That's an archetype for us.
You know, in your previous broadcast, you accurately describe the new normal of the breakdown of cognition. People can no longer think, which addresses the idea that they're willing to destroy their own history, not thinking that that is what defines them. And what are the root causes of this breakdown in cognition, and how is this allowed to happen?
It comes overwhelmingly from the private sector. In the Western world, in the capitalist world, the state government is simply reactive. It does what it's told. The state can't function for five minutes without private capital. It doesn't have any money without the banks forwarding it cash. It has very little money of its own anymore. The debt is so high. The private sector runs everything. The need to consume, the need to have a purely global system, our identity gets in the way. And our identity is really the only thing that stands in the way of a purely globalized economy. You can't have a globalized economy with people who know who they are. So on the one hand, essentially think of the third world invasion of Europe. Think of that as a reserve army that capitalism can use to silence any kind of white demands for better treatment for labor. If workers come from all over the planet, and to hardly even speak the same language, they're not going to trust one another. When the system creates and invents, most of these racial issues are invented completely. I mean, we know that no racism exists in America except against white people. Whites do not think racially. They will attack you. They'll condemn you. They'll destroy you for thinking racially. On the other hand, non-whites think exclusively in racial terms. Everything comes down to race.
That's such an excellent point. And, you know, speaking of someone who knows who they are, Vladimir Putin has really shaped Russia into a country that knows what it is. What are your thoughts on what's going on with the new changes in Russia, with the changes in the election, the changes in the marriage laws? And the second part of that question is, why is Russia so vilified by the U.S. government, the liberal press, and the so-called deep state?
Well, this is my area. I was at the Barnes Review in Spotlight in 2001. I was the very first person to say that Putin is one of us. If you remember, the right wing hated him when he first came to power in 2000 because he was former KGB. And the right wing was saying this is a restoration of communism and everything else. I was the only person to say that you're wrong, that the patriotic elements, even in the Soviet era, were going into the security services in the army, that Marxism really didn't matter in the 70s and 80s in Russia. It didn't really, you know, it wasn't taken seriously there like it is in the Western universities. I then converted Willis Cardo and Michael Collins Piper and a few other people, and they went on to convert a whole lot because they had a lot of influence. And suddenly the whole Putin is a right-winger came into existence. That is exclusively my creation. That's my donation to the world. And this whole Putin, you know, right-wing coalition comes exclusively from me. And I took a lot of crap at the time for it. And people were calling me a communist and a fascist in the same sentence. You know, apparently not knowing either one.
Right.
So that comes from me. I was the first one to do this. And, of course, I have my book, Russian Populist, The Political Thought of Vladimir Putin. It's the only book in English that deals with his political ideas. What are his basic ideals for the world? And when he took over a government that essentially didn't exist. The military chain of command was in pure chaos. Taxes were not being collected. population was plummeting, and the oligarchs, this handful of overwhelmingly Jewish billionaires, ruled the country, especially at the local level. It was a mafia state, kind of like Albania is today, or Ukraine, for that matter. And he began, you know, with his contacts in the military and security services, he began to rebuild the state. He took Russia from what was essentially a third world country in 2000 to a superpower by roughly 2006, 2007. That's almost unheard of. There's very few people who could claim a transition that severe in that fast amount of time. This is why he's popular. This is why Russians would kill for him. This is why he's the most trusted man by every poll you could think of in the Russian Federation. Putin knows something. He knows that the West is the font of liberalism, is the official ideology of the Western world. It is taken for granted. This is what you have to be a government worker, to be a big name in the private sector. You have to be a liberal in one form, a conservative liberal or leftist liberal. It doesn't matter. You're a globalist in either case. This is what you have to be. The liberal parties in Russia, supported by the CIA and USAID together, I mean, it's like three or four of them, they poll maybe 6% today combined, even though they have a lot of the media on their side, which is why state media is very important. Russians despise liberalism because, of course, they rightly associate it with the meltdown of their country in the 1990s. Male life expectancy by 1997 was like 58. 80% of the economy vaporized. That never happened before. When Germany invaded the Soviet Union in 1941, roughly 40% of the GDP was damaged. This was 80%. They associate liberalism and the U.S. with those policies, and rightfully so. That was essentially they took over the government. Now I just didn't.
What's amazing is everything that he implements, like organic food, going against the globalist GMO agenda. I mean, he's transformed Russia into a place that I'd like to live in for sure.
Yeah, if my conversational Russian was better, I didn't have kids, I would be there. There's no doubt I'd get a job at a university right away. The economy is far more rational, and I have a paper, I think I have more than one, rejecting the idea that Russia is dependent on oil money. That's not true. Between 9 and 11% of the GDP is based on oil. Norway is far more dependent on oil than Russia is. That's an old myth, and it doesn't matter anyway, because even if it were, the massive gold reserves that the Russian state has bought up over the last 10 years would protect it anyway. But it has a massive scientific establishment, a massive high-tech establishment. But their markets really are Central Europe and the Far East. You know, sanctions. Remember, there were no sanctions on the Soviet Union. Trade between the West and the USSR was constant, even in high-tech areas. You had Soviets training in American in American high-tech universities. You know, the computer systems in the 70s, when they first came out, were being shipped to the USSR. There was no sanctions on the Soviet Union. Only when a nationalist or a Eurasianist takes over, all of a sudden now it's a problem. Now Russians are evil. Now there was no Cold War. You can't have a Cold War when you're financing your enemy. The Soviet Union was being bailed out over and over and over again. Whenever they got in trouble with their food supply, Archer Daniels Midland would send food over. They would never have existed if Woodrow Wilson didn't continue to pour food into the Soviet government. The Soviet Union was never condemned by the U.S. unless it began building a coalition that might edge the U.S. out of the international trading game. That's the only time they had any problem with the USSR. Otherwise, it was never ideological. Most Americans don't know what Bolshevism is, certainly not in 1918. And betrayed with the Soviet Union in every area. You know, their electrical grid came from GE. Their mining institutions came from the big mining firm in Alaska, name escapes me. Their oil company came from Rockefeller or Amoco. You know, their automotive came from Henry Ford, who built the largest Ford plant in the world in Soviet Ukraine in 1936. Their entire heavy industry economy came from the U.S. U.S. Steel created their steel industry. During the Depression, the Soviet Union was built by the West. And Anthony Sutton's three-volume book on the topic has great detail on how the Soviet Union was actually built and created, as well as its military. And, of course, yes. During World War II. So Lend-Lease never really ended. And all that debt was forgiven. And it continued. The Soviet Union wasn't part of the Marshall Plan, but they were, in a sense, because the Lend-Lease just continued almost into the 50s. So the point is, only when Putin takes over do you have this condemnation of Russia and Russians. Prior to that, it was not a problem. Prior to that, it was not a big deal.
Yeah, that's really interesting that the Soviet Union was certainly supported, and Anthony Sutton's books on that subject are really incredible.
Okay, we're at the top of the hour. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back here on the Scorpio Conspiracy Show. I'm here with Giuseppe, and we're going to finish up the interview with Dr. Raphael Johnson and then have a little commentary for the end of the show. Okay, here we go. And one thing that strikes me when I listen to Vladimir Putin talk or give a speech is that his dialectic, the way he speaks, is very, very complex. And he tells the general public quite complex policy issues, where in the United States, all we hear is, you know, rhetoric, we got to stop racism, systemic racism, and there's really no substance to anything that the general public hears. And it's incredible the dumbing down that America has gone through versus the level that Russia is on right now.
Well, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that in a while. And the reason for that is that in the East, the state is more powerful than capital. Capital serves as the pleasure of the state. It has to, given what happened in the 1990s. In the West, capital controls the state. You know, the most ridiculous thing I've never voted. I've never voted because I can't put my name on the ridiculous campaigning system. Now, I've worked on campaigns at every level in many states for ideological reasons, but I can't support a system where you have presidential debates that are purely scripted. You have these mindless rhetorical points. And of course, because the media won't cover it, the real big issues in global politics, no one knows anything about. Can you imagine going to Joe Biden, asking him about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization? You know, what look you would get. Or you know, the Silk Road Initiative, or the coming war between Russia and between China and India. You know, that this would, you know, oil exploration in Siberia or Nigeria. These are the issues that are reshaping the world. And it's the last things that are ever going to come up during any kind of campaign. My favorite American electoral campaign is the 1960 presidential election. I've always been fascinated by it. It was a watershed for a whole lot of reasons. The debates are on YouTube in full. You watch these, you're going to learn something. They're at a very high level. It was not meant for a mass population. It was serious, detailed policy analysis, and the debate was over actually specific things. When Putin speaks, again, yes, he's speaking of specific policy provisions. Now, voter turnout in Russia is much bigger than in the U.S. There's more political parties than in the U.S. There's more private media than in the U.S. Not that that really matters. State media is absolutely necessary to counterbalance media owned by Western billionaires and the former empire of Kaczynski and the oligarchs. That's why state media is actually pretty critical of Putin. There's state-owned media, state-controlled media, media that has some state influence. These are very critical of him. That doesn't mean they're just going to support everything he does. Journalism actually does exist, does function over there. You have major newspapers from every conceivable ideological point of view. You know, I don't think anyone go into journalism just to write things that they see. Anyone can do that. They're there for a specific reason. So you're absolutely right. The level of, and of course, the Jewish question is mainstream there. You know, talking about Jewish control over politics is day to day. It's on TV. They debate that stuff in the Duma all the time. It's normal. You see those books on the bookshelves. You know, we've had the Holocaust conferences there many times. You know, that's mainstream. And it's because of the 1990s, where the oligarchs, with one exception, Vladimir Putanin, were entirely Jewish. And back then, the media reported that. And that's why it was so important for the Washington Post to buy up the press and make sure. But they failed. You know, one of the things that Putin did that made himself very popular was the arrest of Mikhail Khodorkovsky. This was, what, 2005, something like that. He was on his way to sell a huge chunk of the Siberian oil fields to ExxonMobil, meaning that much of Russia's independence would have been compromised. He was arrested on the way to that meeting. Now, of course, he hadn't paid taxes in 10 years. He had a lot of crimes he had committed, so that was no problem. They had probable cause. The real reason they got him was because what he was going to do. I don't know if you've seen that video on YouTube of Putin yelling at Oleg Deripaska, one of the richest men in Russia, because his company, I think it was aluminum, was going to move out of Russia and go to Central Asia. And Putin shows up with a contract, and he sits at the head of the table, and he says, "No, you're not going anywhere." And he forces everyone to sign this paper.
Yes.
You've seen that video. Some of this.
Yes, I have. And my favorite part of it is when he wants his pen back when they're all done.
Yeah, give me back my pen. And you should you, yeah. You saw Deripaska's face. He was scared. He's done this many times. This is why people love him. You could never do that in the U.S. because capital rules the state rather than in the East. It's the other way around. What Putin did in rescuing Russia from almost total dissolution was unheard of. I mean, Hitler kind of did it in the 30s. Chung Hee Park in South Korea did it in a few years in the 60s. Putin did it. It's very rare to find somebody that could rescue a country from fourth world status and almost dissolution to a superpower that apparently can control elections all over the world in, what, less than 10 years.
So if you believe the fake news media, Donald Trump is our Putin, right? Fighting everything and not serving the agenda in the best interest of the American people, which is an absolute lie. Why do you think Trump is being so vilified and attempt to destroy him when in reality he's giving the Jewish oligarchs everything they want and more? He's put the embassy in Jerusalem. He's allowed just insane thievery, as you mentioned earlier, by the central bank and this new entity called BlackRock to just steal hundreds of trillions of dollars. And yet they're still sending all their deranged attack dogs like Schiff and Nadler and what have you for 3.5 years to try and destroy this guy. Why are they so after Trump and want to remove him?
You know, I grew up in New Jersey. We were part of the New York media market. And in the 80s when Trump first came to prominence. So that guy was on the news, you know, every night when I was a kid growing up. You know, he's the second nature to talk about him. He was never political. I don't remember him making a political statement until he ran for president. But there were a few things about him. Number one, despite his money, he was never part of the regime. He did his own thing, he had his own independent base. He never was a part of it. Even in Hollywood, he had his own agenda. And he was very unpopular there for that reason. Number two, he wanted to limit illegal immigration. It was corporate America that began to vilify him when he first started his campaign, not anyone else. It was Sears and Roebuck, I think, was the very first company that went after him. And you do a little bit of research, you realize just how dependent the American economy is on illegals. They're a huge part of the workforce in the southern part of America. And they don't have to be paid very much. You can do whatever you want with them. They could be used against white workers. The American capital is very dependent on immigration. And he didn't want to stop it. He just wanted to limit it. And that you know, brought out venom in these people. They invented an entire story that he's a racist and white nationalist and everything else. He's never said or even implied anything like that. And third, and don't forget this, he's made it a huge priority to round up the child molestation pedo rings in this country and everywhere else. This made him very – so far – I remember he was in office less than 6 months, and he had rounded up 1,800 people, a huge number of professors, by the way. And most of these people were elites. They were governors. They were state senators. They were multimillionaires. And this is one of the things that had people panicking. He was – and I think the number is far higher now. Most of these people pled out. They pleaded guilty. To something. The press really didn't cover it very much, but that was a huge reason for this. They invented an entire story. I have never come across the press vilifying someone like they do Putin in American politics. Nixon, I guess, is the closest thing. They've invented stories out of whole cloth, like the stupid Taliban thing that I was talking about yesterday. They simply invent it. They know it's not true. They know the Russiagate thing doesn't make any sense. The Russiagate thing has nothing to do with any kind of hacking. I read the NSA report on that. It has nothing to do with it. It has nothing to do with the final vote tallies. That was completely invented. The Russiagate thing has to do with people like me, that there's too many pro-Russian trolls out there having an influence. That's what Russiagate is. It has nothing to do with computers at all. They simply invent over and over the things that they've concocted about this man, all these rape charges and everything. There is nothing. And the point is, once he was elected – the regime says we're going to make sure that he can't govern. And so whatever he does and whatever he says, he will be vilified and attacked. They claim he's melting down. They claim that he's unstable. No matter what, he could be the most wonderful policy, even from their point of view. And they'll take an angle that says, if you remember the story, that that trans freaks were killing themselves in huge numbers when Trump took over. He didn't even talk about that issue. They were just
right, and active suicide rate amongst those people has always been very high because they, you know, they suffer from a severe form of mental illness.
Yeah.
And you know, I've said for some time that Trump could drink a glass of water, and they'd criticize him for wasting precious natural resources.
Exactly. Which tells you, though, you know, that's what happened when anyone even remotely close to our point of view gets any kind of prominence. What they're going to do. Yeah, that man could have retired to an island somewhere. And he wants a second term? I wouldn't want a second term. You know, he ain't having fun up there. And his kids are being vilified. There is no boundaries with these people because of those issues. Because he financed his own campaign. He didn't need their money. He went to AIPAC, if you remember. And he said, I don't need your money. And the anti-Semitism in the press was, you know, his rally in Oklahoma, they claimed, was the reason for the COVID explosion there.
Of course.
Any reference to Black Lives Matter, but to the riots, to the demonstrations, no, that's the reason. And it's almost like the press, no, actually it is, the press trying to see how far they can go. What can we invent? What stories can we invent that people will accept, that the press will accept? The Taliban story is so ridiculous. Yeah, the Democratic Party, even some Republicans, are using it as a platform now. None of it makes any sense. No one has been harder on Russia than Putin has, and than Trump has. The sanctions have been more intense. The military buildup has been more intense. The whole Ukraine thing that got him impeached had to do with military aid to Ukraine, which is being used against pro-Russian entities there. Well, I thought he was Putin's puppet. It doesn't make any – so I say breakdown of cognition. They can't see that the Russiagate thing is denied by the reason that they impeached him. You know, are they so ignorant about what's going on over there? You know, I mean, it's a total breakdown of thinking, total breakdown.
Absolutely. And, you know, what's interesting is that Trump's immediate, you know, political instinct was to get closer to Russia, build stronger ties, because it was, you know, the right political move and the right geopolitical move to strengthen America. And of course, they stopped him from doing that from the very beginning. And one thing that John Bolton said when he was criticizing Trump, you know, for his new book, and, you know, of course, Bolton's a war criminal, essentially, is that people don't like Trump because he trusts his instincts too much and doesn't listen to his advisors. And I thought that was a very revealing statement.
Did you hear my show on the topic? Because I mentioned that precisely. I did my show on Bolton's book with Sven Longshanks. I think it was last week. Yeah, it was last week.
No, I haven't heard it. No.
Well, you know, I actually read the thing, you know, 550 pages. I actually read the book. And, it, you know, he claims to have been in the room when, in fact, he was not. Mike Pompeo finally did something right. And he said that this man is full of it. He wasn't there. In fact, they deliberately marginalized him because they didn't trust him. He was the leak in the White House. He was a very dangerous man, a war criminal, no doubt. I mean, he wanted to, you know, he's like typical neocon. He wanted to invade the world with a military that's falling apart, a military that can't win anything, a military that's been beaten in almost every, actually, no, in every engagement it's ever been a part of. It surrendered. In Afghanistan, those peace talks are surrender talks. They're being driven out of the country. And just as that happens, they invent the whole Taliban bounty story, which is laughable. It's just this demonic, emotional obsession with destroying somebody who humiliated them. He wasn't supposed to win. He wasn't even supposed to run for president. Not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to run for president and not be a part of the party establishment. You're not allowed to finance your own campaign. You're not allowed to say those kind of things. They see what he can do. He could verbally eviscerate these people. He's not allowed to do that. And what terrifies me is, well, what terrifies me other than what's going to happen in November, one way or the other, you know, the polls are completely false. These same fake polls they were doing, they're interfering with the election already. There's going to be a lot of voter intimidation. What terrifies me is that anybody, even at the local level, who gains any kind of prominence who's on our side is going to get the same thing. He's going to get the same treatment. It's going to be a brutal ride for anyone who even has some prominence in that area. You know, if I today were to become a professor at a big university, can you imagine what would happen to me, what they would invent, what they would come up with? That goes for any one of us. It would be total personal destruction.
You mentioned in a excellent recent article entitled Freedom and Cognitive Dysregulation, The Fantasy World of Postmodern Empire, you write, open the quote, Paul Tepete would be a major name in music today if he told the line, I'd be a tenured professor somewhere, or maybe even a professional musician. Willis Carto will have been a multimillionaire publisher. Edgar Steele would be a rich lawyer in Idaho. E. Michael Jones would be a tenured professor at St. Mary's. Michael Hoffman would be with the Associated Press. William Pierce would have been a famed physicist. Ted Gunderson would have been permitted to retire from the FBI in peace. But none of this happened. Had society been healthy, this is what they'd be doing. But it isn't, because we saw the truth in a world based on deception. And to me, you nailed it. Doesn't this really mean that the world is under the sway of something incredibly evil, satanic, Luciferian, whatever name you prefer? How else can you explain what is going on, the premise of your article, and the reality we're all living?
You know, even if I were a secular man, I would have no choice but to come to that conclusion. You know, the level of, you know, cognitive dysregulation, that is the phrase. Because the people who are doing this are otherwise intelligent people. They're not idiots. And yet they sound like schizophrenics. In their drive to destroy anybody that even remotely disagrees with them, even if they only heard, they don't read any of these guys. They just hear that they're terrible and agree with it. This has never occurred in American politics before. No, it's never even come close here. And the fact that all of these issues, all of these organizations have limitless money, they always seem to win. They seem to be a unified force. They get away with murder in most cases, where our people are sitting in jail for absolutely nothing. It seems very well regulated. It seems very well led at a secret level. And And no one seems to be able to do anything about it. Yeah, that is Luciferian. That is, it does suggest that there's a spiritual force far more powerful than any political actor. Because it just can't be done otherwise. Society's too complicated. These movements are too large. There's too many people. You figure that you'd have too much opposition, but it doesn't exist. After Charlottesville, our movement fell to pieces. And despite Antifa, having attacked us at every step for decades, we put 3,000 guys into the field, and all of a sudden, we're the problem. Antifa was saying they're going to be there to kill us, but we're the ones who are now being sued for not me personally, but we're the ones who are being sued for going down there with violent intent. But in fact, we actually had a permit, and no one can say anything. A jury put these kids away in Charlottesville without any evidence. There's, this poor kid in the car, James Fields. I've seen the video from multiple angles. He never hit anybody. He didn't hit this girl.
Right.
So what kind are they talking about? You could prove that they didn't hit this girl. She died of a heart attack. So what's he? It's a life sentence.
Did you see where the New York Times photoshopped a flying black man into that picture with a car? I mean, the level of insane lies at every level. I mean, it seems as though, based on your eloquent answer, that we're really under the sway of a Luciferian fascist state right now, which is terrible. And yet, if you watch the media, the Antifa and Black Lives Matter are the heroes. And we have stepped through the looking glass, don't you think?
No, there's no question about it. But one of the things that gave me some hope was a Trump victory. I just figured there's no way this guy could win. There's no way, when you have people going to his rallies, being forced to go through a gauntlet of screaming people, threatening them. You had voter intimidation right at the polls, which is completely illegal. Nothing ever happened there. And yet he still won. And, of course, he won by a large margin. I mean, the polls in America are worthless. But what they're doing now – so, yeah, to the looking glass, I mean, that's being very nice about it. But when the press is able to create these images and people don't even – I don't think people know what Photoshop is. Most pictures – there's Photoshop pictures of me out there. Most pictures in newspapers have been – dressed up in one form. I mean, not severely, but most of them have been dressed up in one form or another. The picture of the black guy, I know exactly what you're talking about. Given the angle of the car, it doesn't make any sense he'd be in that position. Nothing he did would suggest he would be in that crazy, almost upside down.
Right.
They photoshopped stuff all over the place. They sent that guy with the swastika, if you remember that picture. I saw him coming in. No one knew who he was. He came in all by himself. That swastika flag had just come out of the box that had all the folds in it. He said nothing to anybody. The swastikas were banned in that rally. I wish someone would have taken it from him, but I was too far away. And then when it was over, he left all by himself. He didn't say a syllable to anybody. No one ever saw him before. No one knew who he was. So you come to your own conclusions. He wasn't one of us. But that's the
classic.
See.
Classic.
Yeah. You know the picture I'm talking about, right? The one guy with a swastika and the whole thing. He wasn't supposed to have that. We said that. So, this is what they're able to do. And so when you have the press that's able to invent this stuff, to create this alternative reality, and people don't seem to know what Photoshop is, they don't seem to realize that what they see – they claim not to trust the media, but they watch it every night. They still read the papers. Especially when it, and these issues, when it comes to any ideological controversy that the press really is into, they will simply invent things. Joe Biden's gone a little bit too far with billions of people killed by guns in the last year, whatever stupid thing he said. But these people have come very close to that. Whether it be domestic violence or whether it be the Holocaust or anything else, there is no reality here. They could simply say whatever they please, and people will get fired from their jobs if they ever Yeah, can you imagine a system that says your non-whites are victimized, and if you disagree, you'll lose your job?
It's proving
that they're not victimized.
Right.
Proving that they're more powerful than you.
And how about in these multiple psyops they're running, and what are your thoughts on the entrainment where everyone must wear a mask because the state says so, even though there's countless documentation that the masks are useless and actually bad for your health, and in many cases give the potential to build a virus load in the dampness of the masks and make you sick. I mean, it's pure insanity, but, you know, I know Scorpio this past week went out and was mask shamed, and I was mask shamed yesterday, and it's just insane. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't even know where my mask is. I haven't worn a mask in public in months now. No one said anything to me yet. I remember when this first happened, I was deliberately going against the one-way aisles in the supermarket. I was actually seeking them out. But no one ever paid any attention to that. The German ME examiner, who's the head of that department at Hamburg in Germany, Hamburg Medical College in Germany, now I think is on his 300th or 400th autopsy of people dying from COVID, and not one died of COVID.
Exactly.
Everyone had severe, whether heart problems or cancer, or they got hit by a bus or something. There's not one person that he can find that died simply of COVID and nothing else. I want to know.
Yeah, it's amazing. And these COVID tests are totally bogus. All they do is test for COVID virus. It's nonspecific. And, you know, that's the common cold, the common flu. So everyone's been, exposed to that throughout their life. So you're going to get, you know, millions of false positives in this. And it just fuels the flames of this crisis we're in, you know. Okay, we're at the bottom of the hour. We'll play the final segment coming right up. Okay, thanks to everyone who was listening out there on Revolution Radio. I'm here with Giuseppe, and we're going to finish up the interview with Dr. Raphael Johnson and then have a little commentary. Okay, here we go.
It's very convenient to have this non-human enemy that you can't see, that no one knows anything about, that could be lurking anywhere. You know, I don't think anyone actually believes the mask works, but it's a talisman. It's something that people wear to tell the world, see, we're in this together, this kind of crap.
Yeah, it's a symbolic act of submission to the will of the government, too.
Well, all you have to say is that I'm exempt. That's all you have to say, and they're not allowed to ask you why, because that would be a HIPAA violation. Now, no one said anything to me yet. I haven't worn a mask in a long time. I haven't even gotten looks. Now, around where I live in Cambria County, not a whole lot of people wear masks. North of me, very few people do. I think if you went into the big cities, you would see it. But all you have to do is say that I'm exempt, and that's the end of the story. I think one of the big chains around here had a sign that said, if you're not wearing a mask, we will respectfully assume that you're exempt. And they're not allowed to ask you why. That's all you have to do to get out of it. But I was very happy when the snitch line came online. You remember that you could report people. My God, you know, Dunder Mifflin must have gotten 10,000 complaints on that snitch line. I was putting my ex-wife into all kinds of things that she was violent. Yeah, you know, we were loading that line up with BS responses. I think we shut that line down in a few states. We almost did in Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, in Pennsylvania, we have that freak of nature who really should come with a warning label. I'm scrolling down my Facebook feed. I'm scrolling down my Facebook feed, and I see this thing. She needs to be blurred out.
Oh, the medical commissioner or whatever that title is, that's so bizarre.
Yeah, Levine, the Hindu, yeah.
yeah.
You know. And it's in Tom Wolfe's this condescending, slow way of speaking. We know the death rate is almost non-existent, and it keeps going down. We know that this generally only targets the very, very elderly. That flu numbers have disappeared somehow. I had no idea the flu killed that many people every year. But far higher.
Yeah, me either. And you know, other things, you know, people don't want to sit around and think about how many people die every day. And that's part of the reason they've gotten away with this is that, you know, thousands of people die every day. Hundreds of thousands of people die every month. And so it's really, this is how they're able to hide this fraud, this scam.
Well, let me put it like this. And this occurred to me when, after 9/11, or even after the Oklahoma City bombing. I could give these people all the evidence in the world that the media is lying to them. I could give them so much evidence that they really can't respond to me. I've had situations where these people will agree with, oh my God, I didn't know that. And I see them the next day spouting the same crap over again. Now, apart from the fact that we can't assume that truth really matters to people, truth is just one factor out of many. Fitting in and, you know, sounding intelligent and sounding like, you know, that's more important than truth. Truth is an abstraction to most people. But the thing you have to remember is if the ordinary normie were to agree with us, what would happen to him? Everything that man would trust in the past now cannot be trusted. It would be a total revolution in his world. He may lose his job. He may lose his family. He starts talking like us. Everyone's going to think he's crazy. They could put him in an institution. His life can be completely destroyed just by repeating some of the things that we say. This happens all the time. This is far more significant. This is why people don't accept it, despite the fact that they have no real answer. They're accepting the regime because of the price, the massive price they would pay if they came over to our side. That's really the issue. Truth is an abstraction to these people. It's an abstraction.
That's an excellent point. Excellent point.
Well, Dr. Johnson, we've already come up to the hour mark, but I just wanted to ask you in closing, what do you see as the future short term for the United States? I mean, where are we heading with our culture and our form of government in the short term?
I don't think the solution is going to be a political one. Politicians don't really have much power, including the presidency. Trump gets reelected, that might be reflective of how things are changing for the better, but not, you know, that they, you know, he can't control the culture. As it stands right now, I think the situation looks somewhat positive for us because people are being radicalized for the first time. People who didn't give a damn about race or the state or so-called deep state now are talking about it. People who were completely apolitical are now talking. People are outraged at the mobs of armed blacks walking through the street and destroying buildings. You have more and more ordinary white people thinking in racial terms. And more people, thanks to the internet and things like that, they simply don't accept it anymore. And you're seeing it everywhere. People who didn't care about politics yesterday suddenly now are angry. Besides that, I think mass inflation is coming. You can't have a depressed economy and yet printing trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars and to have no impact. I think there'll be greater and greater manipulation of the statistics at the Bureau of Labor Statistics and elsewhere. The whole shadow statistics company came into existence because these people walked out of the BLS because they were being told a lie. And they created, it's a great site, by the way. I don't know if you've seen a shadow statistics. It's a pay site, but it's very good. The mechanisms.
Oh, shadow stats. Yeah.
Yeah. I love them. And these are all former BLS employees. The polarization is very clear and it's not a bad thing. Division is not a bad thing because truth is by definition divisive. The battle lines are drawn very clear, you know, and the left has made that easy. You know, if you don't say that you're with us, then you're against us. Well, I have no problem with that.
I'm starting to wonder. I agree. I don't think there is a political solution. And I'm starting to wonder if we aren't reaching a point where we have a society that, you know, just isn't compatible. It's like a bad divorce and irreconcilable differences. I'm starting to wonder if there isn't going to be states and areas that want to simply break away from this government. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, secession is a definite possibility, especially as the debt continues to pile up with no real economic function. A friend of mine had a gun pulled here in Johnstown, had a gun pulled on him at Dollar General. He works there because he was told to put on a mask. Because, you know, the Dollar General has that policy. Now, when he told me that story, I said, you know, get used to it. Because the mental health effects of what's going on in the last few months are only just barely being felt. How's all this stuff going to affect how we relate to other people? The mental health system was in collapse mode before all this. Can you imagine now with no money? And you know, people being shut inside, being terrified, being getting all this conflicting information, being told what to do, being lied to all the time, especially by someone like Levine. What do you think is going to happen? You know, mental illnesses are going to go through the roof. You're going to see incredibly irrational behavior. I guarantee you there's going to be a spate of suicides, white males, as always. You're going to see bizarre behaviors, maybe even the development of even more bizarre religious cults and things like this. You know, the churches simply were following along with government dictates even before they had to. So, you know, I'm looking at, you know, mass collapse on a personal level. But yes, that doesn't mean that the healthy sectors of the population will be silent. It'll be very hard to do this because people are scared. But I have to tell you, my phone's ringing off the hook. There's more events going on now than at any time in the past that I can remember. I'm being invited to stuff all over the planet. There's no way. Even if I cloned myself, I couldn't do it all. And this is very sudden. Having white people thinking racially for the first time is a huge success. If it takes this to do it, then so be it.
Yes, and you know, I agree about the mental health aspect because people's entire perception of reality, what they thought was reality, is being taken away from them. And I'm particularly concerned about the effects on children growing up in a world where you're not supposed to interact with other human beings. It's extremely dangerous. Just the other day, I saw a little toddler in one of those little carriage things, and the mother had put a mask on him and a plastic sheet over the top of the carriage. I just thought that was symbolic, you know, in some ways.
Well, you know, and kids are not getting this. Kids are in no danger here. Most people are not dying from this. That's just pure invented fear. It's pure irrationality. And if right here in my town you get people getting guns pulled on them and fights are breaking out over this stuff, this is going to be happening everywhere. The press won't be talking about it. Now, the great danger we face is that the only people the cops seem to want to arrest are our people. People defending their homes and businesses are being vilified and attacked and arrested. I'm not talking about the St. Louis couple specifically, but even here in my town, those guys, businessmen who know that they can't count on police protection, are standing in front of their businesses with weapons. These guys are all in trouble now. And of course, if they let their business go up in flames, we didn't have much trouble here in Johnstown, but elsewhere, you know, insurance won't cover it because it can't, you know, if it happens in a civil unrest or riot, insurance won't cover their losses. But that suits corporate America quite well. So any kind of defense, you know, it's normalizing attacks on us, you know, whether it be on campus or elsewhere, normalizing physical attacks on us. Is also what's going on. That's the big danger right now. If we defend ourselves, we're in trouble. And this is one of the reasons why things aren't, you know, that these people aren't being confronted in the streets with any numbers, because we know what the cops are going to do.
Right.
I saw this deeply, deeply disturbing video on Twitter two nights ago where a young mother with a young boy, maybe 1-2 years old, was pushing a stroller in a public park, and this big black jogger was she must have said something, and he slammed her in the mouth and knocked her down, and then was on top of her with his knees on her shoulders, punching her full force to the face, and the little 2-year-old boy's trying to stop him. Nobody would help her. And that's the level of subhuman activity that we face, the real citizens of this nation, the decent people of this nation. And how do we stop this? We have to stop this.
In such a case, we would have an obligation to step in, despite what might happen. That's just simply how it is. I've never seen that in front of me before, but we would have an obligation, not even for any ideological reason, just for a simple human reason. And that kind of thing is being normalized. That kind of thing is being – now, these people could talk about killing white people on Facebook and not get their posts removed. But if we attack these people, ours will. You know, they're releasing felons from jail. Were, of course, reoffending all over the place. Like all the revolutionary groups release people from jail. They empty the jails in France, in Russia. Emptying the jails is always a big part of their agenda, even in China. And they're part of this reserve army now that they're using. And, you know, and it was a bizarre thing because, of course, jails are the perfect place to isolate people. If you have someone, I don't know how anyone could get COVID in jail in the first place. That'd be the last place you think you'd be able to get it. They have such limited connection with the outside world. But they have isolation units. State prisons are big. They're the perfect place to isolate somebody. So why are they being released? You know, excellent and now point. you can't get ammunition. Try to get 9mm ammunition anywhere. Guns are being sold out everywhere, which, you know, kind of is a good thing, but we can't get ammunition now. I remember the L.A. County Sheriff, after they had released these prisoners, condemning people for buying guns as a result. You know, this is Soviet tactics. So, you know, they're using these people. They're using these people against us. They're building, as always. They need this reserve army of people who are easy to lead, easy to get angry, and using the most irrational arguments. You know, the systemic racism nonsense, it makes them sound smart using phrases like that. Of course, there is no such entity. There's been the laws. The Civil Rights Act of 1866 bans systemic racism, let alone the trillions of laws that have been passed since then. It simply doesn't exist. And because of that, what they need to do is say that, well, it's inherited. People are racist whether they want to be or not. It's subconscious. They'll invent any story they have to maintain. So any negative outcome for someone who's non-white must be the result of racism. A word, I hate using it because it's like sexism. It's so stupid. It doesn't mean anything. It's simply a verbal punch to the face. But that's how political debate is. It's based on a vocabulary that means absolutely nothing. You could invent, insert whatever you want. So this is a terrifying time, but it's going to try us. The best of our people are going to rise to the top. But trusting the criminal justice system at this point is a crapshoot at best. And that's a terrifying thing. But if you're in a situation like this, like you just described, we'd have no choice. We just have to suffer.
Yeah, that's a very good observation. Go ahead, Giuseppe.
Well, I was going to say I completely agree. And I know we've run late, and I just want to say I admire your work. And admire your courage, and hopefully we can have you back on the show again at some point in the near future.
Well, you guys really, really like me. Damn, must be pretty smart. Holy cow!
Well, I do like I really like your observations and your perceptions and your multi-layered way of looking at things. The complexity of it's really intellectually stimulating. And this hour has flown by. We're actually almost at an hour and a half. I really appreciate your time. And could you give the name of your book on Putin one more time?
Yeah, you know, I have no conception of self-promotion. I haven't mentioned my website or anything else.
Mention them all now.
All right. But I have to be told, you know.
I wanted it for myself because I want to get a copy of it.
Well, my website is rusjournal.org, rusjournal.org. Matt Parrott sent that up for me. He still runs it, wrote the text for it. And there you have it's everything about me is there. My Patreon page link is there. All my book links are there. Some essays, not everything, but some essays are there. A good chunk of them. Links from places I work are there. I'm one of the editors, apparently, of the Warden Post. I keep forgetting about that. Which is a great site. I'm still the senior researcher for the Barnes Review in D.C. I was editor there from 1999 onward, and of course they went bankrupt. So now there's not much money there, but I am. My title there is a senior researcher, and I had the cover story this month. You know, I have so much stuff going on. I'm working on multiple books at once. I can never remember anything. I should be a lot richer than I am. But you know.
All right. And that concludes the fantastic interview with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. Scorpio, what did you think of that?
Well, you know, I thought it was very interesting. I think one of the most interesting pieces of information he brought forward was that the whole question of Jewish power is actually being discussed openly in Russia, and it's even on television, and yet somehow there, you know, a second Holocaust hasn't happened, and people are just having a rational discussion about a small handful of people having a tremendous amount of power.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, statement, the greatest success of the devil is to convince people he doesn't exist, and that's what these globalist parasites have done. Oh, it's a trope. We're just philanthropists. It's just so evil.
Yeah, that's a good cover, the old philanthropy cover. Yeah, I'm a good person. I'm giving money away. I made so much, yeah.
Oh, man, and preparing for the Dr. Judy Mikovits interview last night on my new show, which Scorpio is always a part of, called The Perfect Triangle, 6 p.m. Fridays, replacing the good professor James Fetzer. I listened. I didn't play him because she's so fascinating. I didn't use any clips I had prepared. But there was one where the anxious, despicable Bill and Melinda Gates are talking to 400 other philanthropists and just smarmy, arrogant. We as philanthropists have to do more to get people vaccinated. Yeah, you do, because you're a eugenicist, and you should all be hanging from trees.
Well, yeah, and as though vaccines are really going to improve people's quality of life. It's really pathetic. Giuseppe, what was like one of the major points that was brought up that really stuck out in your mind as pertinent and important?
Oh, with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, just the fact that he really issued a call to arms and to act now. You know, if you see someone beating a defenseless woman, you know, I would have taken care of business. I'm going to be 61 next month, and I would have jumped right in there, and I can't believe other people didn't. That video sickened me, and that's just it. And the other major thing I took from it is there's so much interest in him now. And hopefully, finally, white people are realizing it's an ugly world. Whites are a true minority. And in a civil society, in which, honestly, there are a lot of civil blacks, civil Mexicans, civil Japanese, civil Chinese, civil Pleiadians, And they're all here, and we're all, you know, living the great experiment that is the United States. But most of the world is not civil to us. And if we don't band together, we're going to be wiped out.
Yeah, this is a make or break moment. And one thing that I thought was very interesting is he brought up the idea or the concept that corporations have tremendous power. In fact, in the West, they have more power than the governments do now. And I really do think that's true. And, you know, what you were saying, going back to what you were saying, is it's time for people to start to get involved about how we're going to move forward with our society. It goes back to what I was saying earlier in the show. We can't just, you know, sit back and vote and then figure that, well, the government will fix it now. I did my part. You know, it's not going to be that simple anymore.
Well, right. And the other point he made is that the government has no money, and it's constantly going to these transnational corporations, globalist banks. And, you know, the great treachery of 1913 with the Federal Reserve being created by the trader Woody Wilson and on Jekyll Island. It seems to me that if Donald Trump was really the nationalist patriot that he claimed he was and was elected to be, one easy step: nationalize the Federal Reserve, wipe out the debt as a non-real debt, begin printing actual money from the U.S. Treasury, indemnify all businesses that are on these shores to you're good, you know, business as usual, and just eliminate the control of the money system here in America, and that would go so far to change things back to a sovereign nation.
Yeah, and you know, the concept of odious debt is a very valid one, and it's applicable with where we are. So that would be a very good step in the right direction. I think Trump is a bit of an enigma. And I think, you know, like he said, the president really doesn't have nearly as much power as they want us to think. The corporations are calling the shots far more than we think. They determine who gets up for election in the first place. And I do think Trump was a bit of a wild card. And, you know, that's why John Bolton said, oh, he doesn't listen to his advisors too much. He trusts his instincts too much. Ah, we can't control him 100% like we're used to.
Completely agree. In fact, I should be better about writing these quotes down. I remember them, but I don't remember the source. So it's not another quote that stands out is in America, for the great masses of decent people, we live a brutal capitalism. For the globalist parasites and the parasitic elites, they live socialism. So much is given to them. So much is just given or stolen. It's absolutely corruption at its finest.
Yeah, and like Dr. Johnson was saying, the Federal Reserve is papering over the mistakes of these big corporations. They're getting bailouts all the time, and now they still have access to essentially what amounts to free money, close to 0% interest. And, you know, the average person pays close to 20% on their credit card. So it's a criminal enterprise. People need to start understanding that central banking is a criminal enterprise. And it's really the root of so many problems we face right now. Okay, well, that's it, guys. The music is on. And I hope everyone enjoyed the show and our interview with Dr. Johnson.